Welcome to Footsteps of the Fallen, a Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer, Matt Dixon. For over 35 years, I've been visiting the cemeteries, memorials and battlefields of the First World War. And in this series of podcasts, I'd like to take you on a journey through France, Belgium and further afield and tell you the stories of some of the places I've visited and the stories of the men who lie as the dead of the Great War. So pack up your kit bag, pour yourself a cuppa, and join me as we walk the well-trodden paths on the battlefields, following in the footsteps of the fallen. It's a pleasure to have your company. So welcome to this latest edition of Trench Talk, and it's a real pleasure to be joined today by Roger Steward. And Roger is a professional battlefield guide, military historian and author. He lives out on the battlefields of Flanders, and he wrote a fascinating book about the German cemetery at Langemark, and it's about that cemetery that we're going to talk today. And Roger, welcome to the podcast, and thank you very much indeed for giving up your evening to come and talk to me.
So good evening, Matt, and thank you for inviting me onto your podcast. I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting conversation.
I'm sure we will, and say thank you for coming. So, I mean, the first question that I always ask everybody who comes onto the podcast is, do you have a family connection with the First World War? Did you have relatives who fought in the war, and where did your interest in this period of military history come from?
Yeah, so in terms of family connections, yeah, first of all, unfortunately, we have a relative on the Tietbouw Memorial. From a Norfolk regiment killed in 1916. My grandfather on my dad's side, he survived the First World War, but he fought in the Battle of the Somme in the Suffolk regiment at the age of 19. And funnily enough, during COVID, because of course we all had time on our hands during lockdown, I was doing a bit of family research and came across another relative who actually was a professional soldier before the First World War, had left the army, rejoined again in 1914, and went from start to finish in the Army Service Corps. So, like most families in the UK, I would suggest, you know, we have links somewhere, with the First World War and Second World War as well.
So how did you come to be a battlefield guide? Because when you go to the school's career office, as for me, many, many years ago, it's not something that the careers officer suggests that it would be great to be a First World War battlefield guide. How did you get into that and do this for a living?
It's do you know what? It was fate, really, I suppose. And you have to really wind it right back until I was about 10 years old. Now, I'm now 56, so it's going back a few years now. But funnily enough, as I've been talking about this to other people, this kind of theme has come through quite a lot. I got into the First World War in 1970s or late 70s, early 80s because of a kids' comic. Now, I don't know if you remember, but when we were all growing up in that period, all the kids' comics at that point were all World War II stories, you know, like Warlord, for example, Commando. Yeah. But yeah, there was a comic called Battle, which evolved, I think, into Battle Action. And it started to do a comic strip called Charlie's War. And it was all about a First World War Tommy in the trenches called Charlie Bourne. And what grabbed my attention straight away as a youngster then, A, because I've never heard anything about the First World War, to be fair, at that point. But secondly, also, the artwork was very graphic, you know, in terms of the rats, you know, the bodies, the gas attacks, you know, you name it. So you can imagine I was hooked. And I was always a big reader at an early age. So then I read All Quiet on the Western Front. And the rest really was history. I was lucky enough we studied it at A-level at school. But I didn't go to university, elected not to, because at that period in history, you know, it was a bit half and half, you know, half people went, you know, some didn't, and went into work. And I ended up in sales working for, oddly enough, a Belgian carpet manufacturer, which is how I met my wife. But her family all came from Ypres. So we both got made redundant. And we opened up a bed and breakfast in Ypres to keep us going. And then I started to run tours from the B&B. So this was about 2010. So yeah, it was fate, really, I suppose. Everything just kind of fell into place. So I'm one of these lucky people, really, where redundancy for me was a real bonus. It's not a job, you know, I do something that I love. I'm in an area that I love, covering a subject that I'm fascinated by and love as well. And to be quite honest, I meet great people as well. The people who come on the tours want to be on the tours. So, you know, all in all, I'm lucky, I do a fantastic, fantastic job.
I'm sure there are many people listening who probably think you have the best job in the world in that case.
Yeah, I would agree, yeah.
Very lucky to be one of these people where going to work doesn't feel like you're going to work.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and every day is different, and I know the sites are the same, and the facts and figures remain, but it's the people on the tours as well. You know, the family histories, their stories about their relatives. I mean, for me personally, you know, one of the most rewarding parts of the job is taking people to graves. Because even today, we still get people on tours, particularly if they come from the other side of the world, maybe Australia or whatever, who they're the first people to visit, you know, the grave of that person. So that's always an emotional thing as well. So for me, that's arguably the most, the most important part of the work I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of the things on this podcast particularly is the personal side. It's that, I talk about it quite a lot on the podcast, that every headstone is somebody's tragedy. It's somebody's loss.
Absolutely.
And every headstone is a story to tell. And I think as military historians, we have an obligation to tell those stories and keep those memories alive, don't we?
Yeah, very much so. You know, and I often explain to people, because it is very easy, you stand there looking at the names on the wall at Tynecott, for example, or, at the headstones. But you have to remember, these were all human beings, and they all had their own hopes, their own dreams, their aspirations in life, and all of that was taken away for them. So that, the freedoms we enjoy today is because of the sacrifice those guys made. So it's incredibly important, we keep not only reminding people, but as you say, telling their stories.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing as well that's always very important to remember, and understandably, as British nationals, our focus tends to be on the British contribution towards the Great War. But of course, it was this global conflict. And I think what happens, perhaps understandably, is we do have a tendency to overlook the German side of things, that they went through the same privations, the same problems, the same, huge casualties, the same conditions that the British did. And that's why it's always interesting, I think, when you see a book such as you've done that brings the German side of things to life, and particularly written in English.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because we get very, very few Germans visit the area. And it's not because it's a subject of war, because if you go to World War II sites, maybe Normandy, for example, you'll see lots of German tourism there. But the reason is they're not taught much about World War I. So they're taught about World War II at the expense of World War I. So if they don't know much about it, therefore, logically, they don't come. We get a few, don't get me wrong. But it doesn't mean to say, though, that Langemark and the German story is not told. Because Langemark as a cemetery is the second most visited cemetery in the area after Tynecott. And the reason for that is, of course, all the visiting British school groups go there. They're all on the coach tours, which go there. Adult coach groups all go there as well, from all nationalities. And, of course, companies like myself, when the minibus tours, it's one of our stops as well. It's just unfortunately not visited much by the Germans, but the story is told. To quite some degree now, it's a fantastic thing that everybody feels able to go there. But during that period of the 1418 commemorations, it was the second most visited cemetery after Tynecott.
Well, it's fascinating to hear that. So your book that you wrote about the German cemetery at Langemark, called Studentenfriedhof to Soldatenfriedhof, what made you write the book? Because what I find really interesting is that every guidebook you read to Ypres always talks about the cemetery at Langemark. But what is clear from your book is that no one has ever written a detailed study of the cemetery in English in particular. So what made you want to, what was the genesis of this project?
I think that the The thing really was there's two factors really, practicality and professionalism as well. On the practical side, it was kind of my lockdown baby, if you will. I wrote it during lockdown because I finally had time to do it. But I'd wanted to do it for some time because from a guide perspective, it was one of the most frustrating places to take people to. Because as a guide, you know, we see there's lots of local guides here and guides who come into the area as well. We've all got a high sense of professionalism. You know, everybody wants to be correct. Everyone wants to tell, you know, the correct narrative. But that, that depends on, have you got anything to refer back to in the first place? And as you mentioned, nothing had been written about Langemark in any detail. And as a result of that, you found yourself and you started to listen to other guides as well. People were telling different stories about different places or parts of a cemetery, you know, adding two and two together and kind of getting five as well. And lots of myths had sprung up about the cemetery because of that. Well, partly because of that lack of reference material, but also partly because, and we have to be quite honest about it, in the 1950s here, you know, after two German occupations in some people's living memory, there's more than a dislike of the Germans, you know, in this area. So lots of stories kind of sprung up amongst local families here, which were then passed down, you know, the generations. And I still get it on tours today, particularly people who stay in bed and breakfast in town. And when they're having breakfast in the morning, they're having quite close contact with the owner. And lots of the guys here are in the B&Bs, they kind of class themselves, you know, as have a bit of local knowledge and whatever. You know, and the guests will tell the B&B owner, oh, we're off, you know, on tour today, we're going to go to Langemark. And, you know, the B&B owner will tell them, oh, this is where they're all buried standing up. So they repeat that on the tours. No, of course they're not. You know, it's rubbish, but that's what people are told, and therefore they believe that. So from my perspective, I really wanted to write something which would put the facts straight, if you will. Because I found it very frustrating. You know, I end part of last year, I mean, the book's been out well over a year now, nearly 2 years now. End part of last year, I was in the cemetery with my group, and a teacher walks in, English teacher with his school group, stands by the mass grave, opens his arms out and says, ah, this is where they're all buried standing up. You know, and I could have gone back to my van and got my book out and hit him with it, you know, because it was so frustrating. You know, do some research. You know, the research is out there. So that's the reason really why I wanted to, you know, to do the book. Was, as I say, you know, to try and put all of these myths to bed. And, you know, these guys who lay in that cemetery, you know, they deserve to have their story told accurately as well as everybody else does. So that's kind of the reason I did it.
Fascinating. And it sounds like very much a story where fact and fiction might sometimes be quite sort of difficult to separate from what you've been telling us. So how did you go about finding the information? Because I think what's apparent from talking to you is that telling the truth was something very important to you about writing this book. So how did you go about researching it? And did you use German archives? Was it easy to find information or that sort of thing?
Yeah, to be fair, there had been a couple of books written in Dutch on the cemetery, but not to any kind of great detail. So you kind of start trawling through those as well. But the main point of research, to be honest, was the German War Grave Commission, the VDK. And I had a lot of contact with them. And, you know, during COVID as well, you know, they were available. There's lots of digitization online. And I say online, you can contact them and they'll send you stuff. But they were incredibly open and very happy to send me pictures, copies of plans, explain things, why this was this, and you know, and I would tell them some of the myths, and they would tell me, well, no, that's not correct, this is because this, and so the German War Grave Commission really were the core in terms of writing the book, in terms of information, and I can't thank them enough, because their openness was phenomenal, and I think they were generally happy that somebody was finally taking the time, you know, and effort to kind of put the facts straight. So really the German War Grave Commission were key to this.
So for some of our listeners who may never have either heard of Langemark Cemetery, perhaps never have been there, could you put it into context as to where is it in relation to Ypres?
So it's about, if you drive out towards Passchendaele, it's about 3, maybe 4 miles from Ypres itself, fought over really from 1914. That's when that area was first fought over, and of course been back again in 1917 and 1918. It's one of four German cemeteries now in the area. Actually, it's the second largest. The largest at Menin has 48,000 burials, where Langemark's got 44,000. It's well signposted from Ypres as well. Once you get to Langemark itself, it's quite within easy reach of Ypres itself.
So how did the cemetery first start? And one of the things that I want to ask you about, because I was particularly interested to read in your book, was this story about, I think it's referred to as the Kindermord. And perhaps you, for our listeners, you could maybe just explain what that relates to. And as I say, how did the cemetery at Langemark first sort of come into being?
Well, the cemetery itself is no different, really, when you look at it. At that point in history, to the British cemeteries, because behind the lines, of course, the Germans were burying their dead. So German units were forming their own cemeteries, much as British units were. So when you come to the end of the First World War, in the Ypres Salient, as there was everywhere else, there was German cemeteries everywhere. I think there was about, if I remember rightly, about 184 in the Ypres Salient, German cemeteries. And if you go to France today, you'll still see German cemeteries dotted around all over the place. But in Ypres, because they're all consolidated in the 50s, which you know I'll probably go for in a little while, you only see four now. But if you toured the area up until the 1950s, by that point there was about 170, but initially there was 184. But they're formed by units or German units. So any German cemetery which was there at the time was formed by German units, of course, during the war. And then you got a situation in the 1920s when the British Army Labour units are clearing the battlefields of bodies. Of course, if they come across German bodies and there's a German cemetery ground or burial ground nearby, they're quite often reburying the German burials in those grounds as well. So it's kind of a natural evolution, really. But they start, from the German army themselves during the war. Now, the thing in terms of the Kindermord, that really comes about because of the Battle of Langemark, October, November 1914. So you're right at the beginning of the war. And regiments of young regiments of German volunteers, we'll say, but crucially, those regiments had been raised in university cities. Now, they had very little training. They rushed to the front. But unfortunately for them, outside of Langemark, they come up against a fully trained BEF, the fully trained professional British Army of the day. These are hard, professional Empire soldiers. So it's a one-sided affair. So the estimates are around about 3,000 Germans were thought to have been killed. And, of course, the German army in the days after this can't really admit this because, of course, it's bad for morale, bad for propaganda. So in the German army communique printed in the German press, they kind of embellish it and they kind of turn it into a glorious kind of defeat, if you will. And they tell the story of these German soldiers, gloriously stepping over the bodies of their comrades, willingly giving their lives for the fatherland. So that's how it's portrayed during the First World War itself. Now, if you then go back to the 1920s, and crucially now that period of Hitler's rise to power, and this is where the real myth of the Kindermord now starts, because Hitler, after his failed revolution in Munich, is now kind of languishing in his jail cell and he's busy writing Mein Kampf, and he's looking for German heroes to portray, for his own political purposes. And he hits on the story at Langemark, and he twists it for his own political purposes to what we now call the Langemark myth, the Langemark legend. And the first thing he does is, crucially, he links himself to it. Now, he doesn't say outright in Mein Kampf that he was there, but he kind of hints that he was, and that's enough. What he also does, though, is because these soldiers or these units came from university cities, he portrayed them as all being students, which they weren't. Okay, we know they're all of different ages. And the other thing he does, he kind of portrays them all as being kind of good ethnic Germans of the time, you know, kind of blonde-haired, blue-eyed kind of boys. And again, that's not the case, because when you look at the names of those soldiers involved, because the boundaries of Europe, of course, are very different then, there's lots of what you would class as modern-day Poles, for example, fighting for the Prussian army. And, of course, he glosses over the German Jewish soldiers fighting for the army in the First World War. But the crucial thing is he's linked himself to this myth. So when he comes to power, of course, now everybody in Germany who wants to be seen as a good, loyal Nazi wants to link themselves to it as well. So all of a sudden then in the 1930s, you've got German cities renaming streets, Langemarkstrasse. Berlin had a Langemark tube station. The 1936 Berlin Olympics, you know, the Jesse Owen Olympics, they renamed the Athletic Hall, or they call the Athletic Hall the Langemark Hall. They even raise an SS division called the Langemark Division, purely because of his links, you know, to Hitler himself. So that's how the cemetery then gets its name as the Studentenfriedhof. Because when the cemetery is designed after the first German War Graves Commission, the first German-Belgian War Graves Agreement in 1926, it's not the German War Graves Commission who have raised funds for this cemetery to be redeveloped. It's far-right German youth groups, because of these links to these so-called students. They've toured Germany, they've raised money, okay, and they take on a designer, a guy called Robert Tischler. And Robert Tischler was a member of the Nazi party at the time, and they give him a very specific design brief, link it to the far right, to the students, and link it to the Nazis, which he's more than happy to do. And of course, they call the cemetery the Studentenfriedhof, the cemetery of the students. So that's how that, you know, the name comes about.
Absolutely fascinating. So I'm really interested in what you said about Tischler and this design brief that was linked to this sort of this kind of right wing ideology. How did that manifest itself?
Well, there's still evidence of it in the cemetery today. The one of the problems in terms of understanding the cemetery is because of these kind of design aspects, if you will, it's had to be redesigned over the years. Okay, it's been redesigned to fit in the extra burials in the 1950s. And of course, in the 1950s, the new West German government after the Second World War suddenly finds itself responsible for a German cemetery in Belgium with all these Nazi overtones. So we have to keep redesigning the cemetery. So even today, though, some of it is still in evidence. Okay, so first of all, when you walk into the main entrance and you take the right hand room, the room of honor, you know, the one with the oak panels with all the names on. On the top of the oak panel is a plaque. And that's the first evidence of, you know, the German students, you know, demands that they want to be linked to this myth. And it basically says, you know, we are the comrades, you know, of the German student associations. When you walk through to the main part of a cemetery, and actually if you walk into the courtyard, for example, and you turn round, I mean, look above the door you've just walked through, there's a plaque above that door, and it reads in German, or translated from German, Germany must live even if we have to die. Now, during the Second World War, that plaque faced you on the wall as you walked straight into the cemetery. It wasn't hidden away above the doorway. And the reason for that was because of a link with the students, the Hitler Youth were in charge of that cemetery during World War II. And that quote came from a German poet called Heinrich Lersch. And it becomes the battle cry for the Hitler Youth. They use it a lot in their rallies in that period. So as you walked into the cemetery, above this big wreath, which would hang in front of the wall right as you walked straight in, would be this quote. So again, post-World War II, the quote was moved out of sight, tucked away above the doorway. And the most overt stuff, though, to be honest, is when you walk up to the area, the Ehrenfeld or the Honor Field, that's the area where the bunkers are. As you look at the cemetery to the right of the cemetery, in between those, there's concrete blocks. And those concrete blocks were originally designed to represent a trench line going between the bunkers. But the German youth groups, these far-right youth groups, wanted also to have their names displayed on these blocks. So they attached on the front of the blocks granite blocks And carved into those in white lettering are not only the names of regiments of men, of course, who were buried there, but names of these far-right youth groups or these far-right groups who had paid for the cemetery to be developed. To be quite honest, some of those organisations have no direct link to the fighting there in 1914 whatsoever. They just wanted to be linked in the 1930s, you know, to the Hitler myth. And so they paid to have their names put up there. So that's kind of the more overt evidence, we'll say, of, you know, of the far right. Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing about Nazism is anyway tasteful, but this whole idea of the politicization of death, you know, and this turning this sacrifice of these German soldiers for political ends, is incredibly distasteful, actually, when you look at it through, you know, modern eyes.
Yeah, very much. And it's quite an interesting one for me as a guide as well, people's reaction, you know, in the cemetery. And I think I make the point in the book, people on the tours have distinguished between First World War and Second World War German soldiers. They view First World War German soldiers more as victims and Second World War German soldiers more as aggressors, if you will, okay? And quite often, you know, I kind of make the point, I mean, this is only my opinion, you know, but I kind of make the point that, you know, I feel sorry for these guys laying, you know, in this cemetery, because don't forget there's German Jewish soldiers buried there as well. And these were these guys' mates. You know, they served in their same units. And they would probably turn in their graves if they knew how they'd been politicized, you know, by the Nazis in World War II.
Absolutely. And I mean, as I said, it must I guess when you're guiding, you have to take your own personal feelings out of it, because you're there, as you say, to educate and to guide and to talk people through whatever, you know, sort of we might feel about it, is saying it, looking at it through modern eyes. And that must be difficult sometimes. And how do people react when you tell them these stories? Have you ever had any adverse reactions from people?
You know what? Only once in all my years of guiding, okay, only once. In that cemetery, and it wasn't anybody from my group, which was interesting as well. I was in the cemetery, I probably had a clipboard or a folder or whatever, and a coach group turned up, and I was standing with my group, and this lady kind of came marching up to me, and she says, and she looked at me, and she looked at the ground, and she says, "Why are there poppies laying on the graves here?" So I explained to her, I said, look, you know, the cemetery is visited by British school groups. They come and lay poppies as a mark of respect. You know, they want to see the war now from both sides, and rightly so. And she just looked at me and said, "I think it's disgusting they do this for the enemy," and just stomped off. And do you know what? My group were just like open mouthed. And they kind of, has she not learned anything? But that's one instance in, you know, 10 years, whatever. Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things I think that I'm always interested in, and this is something that I've, when I've guided people around and we've visited German cemeteries, is what did the Belgians feel about having to give up their land? Because obviously you said that there was sort of 170 odd cemeteries around, and there was this process of consolidation. What challenges did the German war graves have in post-war Belgium to actually get this ground as a permanent memorial? Because ultimately, it's the dead of people who've invaded you. So I should imagine that there was a social feeling that actually we don't really want this.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, World War II has a big impact in terms of what happens to the German cemeteries. Because don't forget, up until the 1950s, you know, you still had, you know, 170 German cemeteries dotted around, you know, the Ypres salient. But when you come to the end of the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, in its wording, technically made Belgium responsible for everybody's war dead on its territory. So Belgium could have found itself paying for all the British cemeteries, all the French cemeteries, their own cemeteries, the American cemetery, and, of course, the German ones. But, of course, as allies to the Germans during the First World War, we've already approached this subject. And what the Belgians have agreed with everybody is they will gift us the use of the land for our cemeteries in perpetuity, providing they're only ever used for military burials. But of course, it's different for the Germans, because during the war, of course, the Germans were the enemy. So there's no negotiation, no talking going on with the Germans. So at the end of World War I, all of a sudden Belgium finds itself responsible for all of these German cemeteries. And the Germans, they're in no interest really to come back to manage them at the time because they're in revolution at the time. So what does it do about it? It's actually very clever what Belgium does, which is nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean that. You know, it puts no money into infrastructure, you know, doesn't do any upkeep in the cemeteries. The cemeteries all overgrow, they start to fall apart. In some areas, they even turn a blind eye to cattle and pigs, or farmers letting cattle and pigs roam through the German cemeteries. But knowing full well that in the 1920s, not only is there British tourists here, you know, families coming to visit the graves of their loved ones, but German families as well. And when they get here and they see the state of their cemeteries compared to the British ones, not only are they disgusted, but they are angry. And they go back to Germany and complain to the German government. And now it becomes official, which is exactly what the Belgians want. So now the German government has to contact the Belgians, and they agree the first ever war graves agreement in 1926, which basically says, yes, you can come back, you can manage your cemeteries, we won't give you the land, we will lease it to you, but you can go and you can design your cemeteries, which everybody seems to be quite happy with. So that's that period, you know, during the 1920s. Then, of course, World War II comes. Interestingly, what happens during that period, of course, part of the deal was the Belgians' demand of the Germans that they're released from that financial obligation from the Treaty of Versailles. But when Hitler comes to power and he occupies Belgium, he demands the Belgian government pays all that money back again. So the Germans, you know, receive money back from the Belgians from the upkeep of their cemeteries. But then, of course, after World War II, of course, the Germans have lost again. The Germans have gone. But now, once again, you know, Belgium finds itself responsible for all of these German cemeteries, which after a second occupation, it's even less keen on, as you can imagine. And also hand in hand with that, you've now got Belgium landowners, particularly in the Ypres area, because that's where the concentration of German cemeteries are. They're putting pressure on the Belgian government. We want our land back. So basically, the Belgian government does the same as before, shuts down all the German cemeteries, bans the German ambassador from coming to the cemeteries, lets them all overgrow. So then you get to the 1950s, and the Belgians and the Germans get back around the negotiation table, and they agree the second ever war graves agreement. But this one's very, very different to the first. So for the first time, to be fair to the Belgians actually offer the land to the Germans on the same deal they have for everybody else, free of charge, in perpetuity. But there's a big caveat to it, which is because of the pressure from the landowners, it has to shrink down from 170-odd German cemeteries down to 4. So basically in the 50s, the Belgians tell the Germans, exhume your cemeteries, dig the bodies up, we'll give you 4 sites, and you can take them into 4, which Langemark was one because it had space. So in the 50s, Langemark goes from 10,000 to 44,000 burials. So it's a real interesting one, Matt, because I often kind of wonder, had World War II not have happened, would we still see 170-odd First World War German cemeteries dotted around the Ypres salient? Because up to that point, up to World War II, you know, the Belgians were reasonably happy to have them, or accepted them, put it that way. But World War II is kind of the breaking point.
Fascinating. And so it's like one of those questions that we'll never know the answer to, but it's a really interesting point, isn't it, about what, you know, history has obviously changed things. One of the questions I've got downstairs in my room downstairs where all my books are, a book that I'm particularly interested in is a book called The White Cross Touring Atlas. I'm sure you know it. And it's the old atlas that was published after the war that showed the locations of all of the British battlefield cemeteries before they were amalgamated and before they were going to condense down into the concentration cemeteries. And it's really interesting when you look at the books, the sort of the visitors' books in the cemetery, where it say that there were graves moved in from this cemetery and that cemetery, and using this you can find it. Is there the equivalent of a German for that? Was there a map that showed the location of German battlefield cemeteries?
Actually, I think you'll find, if you trawl the Commonwealth War Graves Commission archive, And also the archive, which is in for the Ypres League, in the same one there. There's a list amongst that of where all the German cemeteries used to be. So there is record, there is, but from the British side of records, as opposed to the German War Grave Commission. So if you trawl the CWGC archive, you can find a list of where the German cemeteries were.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. I shall have to have a look at that. It's not something that I've ever done before. But
I don't know if you've ever seen it, Matt, because some of the sites partially still exist. It's a strange one because the bodies are moved, of course. So have you seen the site of the old German cemetery near Polkapelle?
I have, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
On the right-hand side there, as you come up to the Beginnemir Memorial on the roundabout. So what you've got now, you've got the site of the old German cemetery. And, of course, the bodies have been removed. But the old wall is still around the area, and it's still got the plaque in the wall of the German cemetery. But it's now been turned into a children's play area with plastic swings and slides and whatever. So that's always an interesting thing as well, to see what happened to the original sites.
Absolutely. I mean, it is fascinating. So, I mean, so really, you were saying it's sort of in the 1950s that the cemetery sort of came to the size that it is today.
Yeah.
So for those of our listeners who have never visited the cemetery, could you talk us through going into the cemetery, the way it's laid out and the various plots that one sees and what they symbolise and what they mean, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, originally, the design principle of the cemetery was to create this illusion of an oak grove, a Bavarian forest, if you will. So if you'd have looked at the cemetery up until the end of World War II, 10,000 burials there, marked of upright wooden crosses, densely planted of oak trees, okay? But one of the problems today is, of course, because the cemetery has been subject to so many design changes because of, for factors we mentioned earlier, and also because of the different way the German War Grave Commission is funded. So when you look at our War Grave Commission, the CWGC, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, it's funded by taxpayers' money, okay? So it's government-funded, so it's your tax money, yeah? The German version, the VDK, is only funded maximum by about 30% by the German government. So it relies heavily on charitable donations. So as a result of that, everything in the cemetery has to be very kind of cost effective and also easy to maintain as well. So it's when you look at the cemetery today, it's very easy, and people do, they confuse the design of a cemetery today, and they think this is the Germans not caring about their war dead. That's not the case. It's just, this amalgamation really of design changes over the years, and kind of lack of funding. So for example, when you walk into our cemeteries, there's professional gardeners in our cemeteries, the CWGC, they're all employed, they're professional gardeners. The German cemetery doesn't have that. But when the grass needs cutting or the leaves need sweeping up, they just, phone up the local Belgian gardening company and they'll come and clear it up. So you don't have that day-to-day upkeep as you do in a British cemetery. So that's the first thing. But as the cemetery looks today, the crosses, the wooden crosses have all gone. Now, that in itself is a really, really interesting story. Because one of the myths about the cemetery also is, not only about the standing up and whatever, but one of the myths also is when you go into the cemetery today, you'll see there's no upright crosses anymore. There's flat stones on the floor. They're called pillow stones, yeah? Now, some of the locals will tell you we wouldn't let the Germans have upright crosses because they lost the war and all that kind of stuff. But that's all untrue, okay? But there's a reason why the crosses were gone. And the reason is World War II. So if you come to the end of World War II, or not the end, but 1944, have you seen Band of Brothers?
Yes, I've, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you know the Battle of the Ardennes, Bastogne, but one of the worst winters in European history. But the German army's gone from the Ypres salient. It's retreated. But as it's retreated, it's stolen everything it can carry, basically. So it's stolen all the food, but more importantly, in terms of this coal, winter fuel. So now you've got a Belgian population not only starving to death, but freezing to death. But what they do have are German cemeteries packed with nice wooden crosses. So they go to the German cemeteries, take the crosses and burn them in their houses. It's survival. But it means, of course, when the Germans come back in the 1950s after that second war graves agreement, that second Wargraves agreement, they find some of the cemeteries have got no crosses left whatsoever. Langemark, for example, roughly half are gone, the other half are rotten. And because of that factor of lack of funding, they stripped them all away. And then for 20 years, from the 1950s to the 1970s, you had a cemetery with no burial markers, pretty much. But then in the 70s, the German War Graves Commission is allocated more money from the German government, and they choose to place those stones. And the reason they choose those is because, A, they're easy to maintain because they're granite. They don't rot away. You can keep the names clean on them. And, of course, you can mow around them easily. Nothing to do with we wouldn't let the Germans have upright crosses. It's purely practical. So when that's the main feeling of the cemetery now is when you walk into the main part of the cemetery, you'll see the oak trees have been thinned out. There's still plenty of oak trees there, but thinned out. And there's no upright crosses anymore. There's flat stones on the floor. But when you walk into the main entrance of the cemetery, it's made of red Visa sandstone, very, very bunker-like as you walk into the cemetery. But as you walk into the initial area, there's two rooms, one to the right, one to the left, okay? The left-hand room, that actually dates as it is now from the 1950s, when the cemetery was, you know, opened out from the 10 to the 44,000 burials. Before that, it didn't really exist. It was just a guard room. But what the Germans did in the 50s, they opened it out, clad it in oak. Everything's clad in oak in those two rooms because the Germans use oak a lot as a symbol. It's like a symbol of strength, in effect. And carved into the oak panel there on the wall is a map of Belgium, actually, and it shows not only the major Belgium towns, but more importantly, the sites of where the German cemeteries used to be pre-1950. So that's what you see when you walk into the left-hand room, okay? But more importantly, when you come out of that room and walk across the hallway into what was called then the list room or the room of honour, and it again completely covered in oak panels, but carved into the oak panels are the names of the original burials in the cemetery. And the reason for that, Matt, is because when the Germans put the wooden crosses in the cemetery originally, they wanted equality in death. So there was no names on those crosses. So the idea is, as a family member, you would walk into the room of honour, you would see your family member's name on the wall carved into the oak, and then there would be a book there. And you would look at the book, you would find his cross reference number or his number for his cross, and you would go into the main part of the cemetery and find his cross. So that room itself, there's 6,000 names there, give or take, okay? Because of the 10,000 original burials, around about 4,000 were unidentified soldiers. And that room in itself has become a bit of a myth because I've heard over the years, you know, teachers tell their groups in there, these are the names of all of the student soldiers. You know, that's not the case. You know, these are the names of the original burials in the cemetery, which are now duplicated on those stones in the original part of the cemetery. So if you walk into the original part of the cemetery and you pick a name, you'll find it on the wall in that room. But interestingly enough, that room becomes a major problem for Hitler. Because Hitler visits the cemetery in 1940, he does this kind of victorious kind of tour of Europe kind of thing, and comes to Langemark purely for propaganda. But you have to remember the very specific narrative that Hitler has told in terms of the Kindermord. First of all, that these are all kind of, you know, good kind of German boys. And when you walk into that room, you'll see it's a very, very different story. There's lots of Eastern European names on that wall, lots of German Jewish names on that wall as well, which means, of course, if Hitler was to go in that room and have a photograph taken in there with a German Jewish name over his shoulder, that's going to blow that myth of Langemark apart. So how do they approach this? Well, he doesn't even go in that room. And the Hitler Youth lock the gates of that room, but also they've covered the room, all of the walls with wreaths, so it's impossible to read any names during his propaganda visit. So when you come out of that room and then you go into the main courtyard, now you're faced by the wall where the wreath used to hang. And then above it, that's where the Heinrich Lersch quote used to be as well. So that's the main entrance, you know, to the cemetery itself. So from there, the original design plan was quite specific. You know, Robert Tischler wanted everybody to follow a certain route, as did the students, you know, because this was designed to partly honour the names of these students. So rather, once you walk into the courtyard, you go straight into the burial area. Actually, the original route took you what they called up the beach alleyway, which is the hedge-lined pathway, and it takes you not into the main part of the cemetery at that point, but to plot B, where the German bunkers are at the back. And that was called the Ehrenfeld, or the honour field. And the reason for that was there was no burials in that area at that point, but you would go there to honour the names of those far-right German youth groups, which were carved into those blocks, as I mentioned earlier, between the German bunkers. Once you'd done that, then you would be taken into plot A, the Eichenhain, to honour the actual burials there. But, of course, this has all changed now, because in the 1950s, when it swells from 10 to 44,000, all of a sudden now the German authorities have to fit an extra 34,000 burials into a cemetery designed for 10,000. So the first thing they do is they rebury 10,000 German soldiers in plot B, the Ehrenfeld. That's the area where the German bunkers are. So they say rebury around about just under 10,000. It's 9,642 they bury up there. And then, of course, they dig the mass grave in the middle there. And it's called the Kameradengrab, or the Comrade's Grave. Now, a lot of people think it's a pit. It's not. It's a concrete-lined room. It's an ossuary. It's got the surface area roughly of a tennis court. It's not very deep. It's only about 1.7 metres deep. But buried there are just under 25,000 sets of remains. So that in itself, you know, that's always, when you tell people this on the tours, you always hear a kind of a sharp intake of breath when you tell people, you know, 25,000 human beings buried here. Now, either side of the mass grave, you'll know there's upright panels with names on. And I'll be quite honest, I was getting this wrong, as everybody, as a lot of people were as well, because for a long time we were telling people that those names, they're the ones which have been identified in the mass grave, okay? And writing the book, I found out this is not the case, strictly the case, okay? And the story is, well, first of all, you have to treat them separately. So first of all, mass grave, back end of the 1950s or mid to late 1950s, it goes in. But those names on those blocks go up late 1980s. And there's good reason for this. And the reason is, at the end of World War II, the German government kind of believed that all of their First World War German army records had been destroyed. So the Prussian records, you know, the Bavarians, the Saxons, the Württembergs, all gone. But when the Berlin Wall comes down at the back end of the 80s, the Bavarian records turn up, and it tells the German War Grave Commission the names of every First World War Bavarian soldier lost in Belgium with no identified grave. And as this was the only mass grave for the unknowns, they decided to put those names either side. So in effect, it becomes like a Meningate for the Bavarians, if you will. But of course, then you've got German families hearing about this, contacting the German War Grave Commission. My great uncle, he was a Prussian. Can he go on there? So he added names to it as well. Now, one of the most famous ones is Werner Voss, you know, the First World War German flying ace. And for years, you know, guys have been kind of shining his name up on the panel there and telling people about Werner Voss and he's buried in the mass grave. Actually, we don't think he is. His name officially only ever goes up there because his family requested it. He was a Prussian. And officially, he crashed near Plum Farm. And officially, his body was never found. Now, there's a chance, of course, he might be in there, but we don't know for sure. So to say he is in there, you know, that's not correct. So by definition, some of those names on the plaques will be in the mass grave, of course. But a lot will be buried in the four cemeteries, and even more probably buried in the fields, you know, in the Ypres salient still. So to say they're all buried there is not correct.
I mean, it must have been very difficult, mustn't it, for the German war graves in the aftermath of the Second World War when you're creating this cemetery, because there's obviously this huge societal desire to distance itself from Nazism and this idea of, you know, the Third Reich and everything it stood for. But then there's a need to preserve the history of the cemetery. It must be a very difficult balancing act for them to do, to sort of say, to keep some of the history of it, but also detach themselves from the symbolism of what it had come to represent.
Yeah, I think a lot of the most direct symbolism, I suppose, or the most extreme symbolism was removable. I've got a photograph of the front of the cemetery, for example. You know, when you see the old World War II films and the Gestapo building's got the long red Nazi banners hanging out the front, they were hanging out the front of Langemark Cemetery at various periods. So, of course, that's all removable. And what they did do, they kind of moved some things as well. Like I say, they moved the Heinrich Lersch quote out of sight. But what they also did was they then put a historical context to it. So when you look at that plaque now with the quote on, they've added a stone plaque beneath it, and it just reads Heinrich Lersch 1914. And so it's the German way of saying, look, this doesn't belong to the Nazis. You know, this is written pre-Second World War, and so they've kind of given it historical context in time. And the only overt thing really now, of course, is the names on the stones. Because I have been told by the few German people we do get on tours, but some of those organisations still exist today and bubbling under the surface, and they're not very pleasant, apparently. But you kind of have to. It's not overt, is it? Unless you really know and you start to look into things, it's not in your face that that's going to be any kind of far right symbolism.
So one of the questions that I wanted to ask is really about the title of your book, the significance of Studententreuhof to Soldatentreuhof. What is that about? Can you tell us?
Yeah, it kind of highlights the evolution of the cemetery, because don't forget the cemetery, you know, originally when it's opened in 1932, has got all these links to the far right, okay, and particularly that myth about student soldiers. So it's those far right groups who pay for the cemetery to be designed, and therefore they name the cemetery the Studentenfriedhof, the cemetery of the students. But post-World War II, in the post-1950s, when, of course, the new German government is trying to lose all of these links to that period, the new designer who comes in, Robert Tischler, dies at the back end of the 1950s, and a new designer is brought in called George Fischbacher, who makes different changes to the cemetery. But one of the most important changes, and probably the most subtle change he makes, is he changes the name. He changes the name from the Studentenfriedhof to the Soldatenfriedhof, the cemetery of the soldiers, which is a lot more accurate in terms of the burials there. So he's removing the ownership of the cemetery away from the far right student groups.
That's a real sort of tangible example, I say, of this move away, this desire to sort of distance from itself, from the sort of the unsavory atmosphere that comes from this association with the students sort of myth.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and it's not a massive change, but I would suggest it's probably one of the most important ones. But there's a real odd contrast at the moment, though, and you may well have seen it, you know, as you pull into the car park at Langemark, because now the official German signage for the cemetery, of course, reads the Soldatenfriedhof. But to pander to tourism, the local town council of Langemark have put brown tourist signs underneath it saying Studentenfriedhof this way. So in effect, they're renaming the cemetery back to how the Nazis wanted it in World War II.
It seems funny that they've done that, really, doesn't it? When you think, I guess you say time has moved on, I suppose, and maybe in sort of modern history, it has lost some of the connotations that it might have had in a different time period.
Yeah, it always makes me smile, though, when I go into the cemetery.
No, I'm sure, absolutely. So you obviously, I mean, the story you told about the removal of the crosses is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, it's, as I say, I mean, it needs must in these terrible winter of the Second World War. But there are some, I believe in correct saying, there are some basalt crosses in the, in the cemetery. What's the significance of those?
Well, again, that's quite an interesting one, because, first of all, they don't represent any graves. They're purely kind of a design feature, if you will. But when you go into the cemetery today, there's clumps of three crosses. But originally, there were clumps of five. Now, apparently, they were originally planned to be put into the cemetery during World War II, but it never happened. So Robert Tischler, the original designer of the cemetery, because originally, apparently, they were meant to represent the hierarchy of the German army. Okay, so they look as a gradient down in size of crosses. But then after World War II, Robert Tischler, of course, who was the original designer, decides he's going to place these basalt crosses in the cemetery. And as a design feature in terms of to represent then kind of a feeling of peace, if you will, you know, around the cemetery. But when you come to that period post-1950s, and the German War Graves Commission, of course, are short of money, and they're forming other cemeteries as well, they take two crosses away from each clump and take them to other cemeteries, purely because of funding reasons. There used to be clumps of five crosses at the back where the bunkers are in the Ehrenfeld. They took all of them away. So I don't know if you've ever visited Wladzlo yet, where Katie Kolowitz's statue is a grieving parents, but they've clumps of two small crosses there. So they're very possibly the ones from, you know, from Langemark, you know, that would kind of stand to reason. But they don't represent, as I say, any burials. And nobody's really too sure what the five cross symbol really means, because when you look at the German War Graves Commission, it's their symbol as well. And I asked them, you know, what does it really represent? And they kind of said, well, we don't really know. It's just kind of always been our symbol. So, yeah, there's lots of stories of what it represents, but, yeah, no one really knows for sure, or so it seems.
Fascinating, isn't it? Some more research to be done then.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So I think one of the things that always strikes me whenever I visit German cemeteries, I mean, they are very different in atmosphere and feeling to Commonwealth War cemeteries. I think there's a degree of, I always think of it as a slightly austere nature to them that you don't necessarily get in Commonwealth cemeteries. What in terms of sort of horticulture, what is there in the cemetery itself?
Oh, very little is the answer, apart from oak trees and the rhododendron bush at the back. There's partly because the Germans, this is how they planned the cemetery. As I said earlier, you know, they want it to resemble, you know, an oak grove, a traditional kind of Bavarian forest clearing, if you will. Another factor also is the fact that, you know, we don't get many German visitors come to the cemetery. So therefore, you don't see many flowers laid on graves or whatever. There's no policy of having, you know, borders around graves, as there are, of course, in our cemeteries. The Germans, obviously, what's the word I'm looking for, commemorate differently to, you know, to how we do as well. And, of course, don't forget, there's a cost implication as well. You know, the Germans, in reality, you know, although it sounds bad that the Belgians say to the Germans in the 50s, you know, we want to consolidate your cemeteries, to be fair, the Germans are happy to do this because it means they've now got four cost bases as opposed to 170. So a lot in terms of design in the cemetery also has to be cost effective as well. But it's primarily down to the original design. It was never planned to have flowers in the cemetery because when we look at our cemeteries, very, very different design concept. You know, we're trying to make our cemeteries resemble traditional English gardens. Kew Gardens do the original planting schemes in our cemeteries. So it's a very, very different kind of concept. But that's particularly how the Germans planned the cemeteries, and that's down to the Kaiser, funnily enough. Right early in the war, he's actually laying down design, you know, pointers, if you will, for how their cemeteries are to look.
Fascinating. And obviously, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned, obviously, when you were talking about Wladzlo, is the Kolowitz statues, the famous, the grieving parents. There are statues in Langemark as well. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, they stand at now with their backs to the wall at the mass grave. So they're kind of back to where they were originally. Now, if any of your listeners have been to Langemark pre-2014, the statues were at the back end of the cemetery where the big rhododendron bush was. But during that period of the commemorations, the Germans decided once again to redesign the cemetery and try and put it back as best they could historically correct. So it's now kind of a mishmash of the 1950s design with the mass grave and how the design originally was. So they put the statues back where they were originally over the mass grave. And they're called pretty much the different names, but mainly the mourning soldiers. And they're designed by a German sculptor called Emil Krieger. And it's based on a photograph taken in 1918 and published in the German press. And the photograph shows a line of German soldiers, and they're standing at the edge of a burial trench, burying, you know, the bodies of their comrades. Now, a few days after that photograph was taken, a couple of those guys were killed. in frontline action. And it becomes quite a famous kind of propaganda photograph of the time in Germany. So he bases his statues upon that. Now, they're very kind of low-key. When you look at the statues, they really reflect the atmosphere of a cemetery. There's no militarism involved there. There's no kind of glory of war or anything like that. In fact, the only way you would know they were soldiers is because they're holding helmets. But apart from that, then they're standing there at the head of the mass grave mourning the loss of their comrades.
I think one of the things that I always feel when I see them is because of the design of them, as you say, I mean, they're very subdued in, and they don't particularly have sort of human form. They're almost sort of faceless. And for me, I find that quite symbolic of the unknown dead.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
It's that anonymity, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And it kind of adds to that atmosphere of a cemetery. Now, my kind of opinion now of the cemetery has changed over the years. When I first used to guide here, I kind of found it quite haunting and whatever. But now I find it a very comfortable place. I think because I've done the research and I know what the Germans were trying to achieve in terms of design, I find it a very restful place, very peaceful place, you know, through that cemetery. But I know a lot of other people come away thinking, oh, they feel quite uncomfortable. But for me, yeah, I find it a very, peaceful is the word, I suppose, yeah.
I absolutely understand that because for me, my when I'm most at peace with myself is when I'm in a war cemetery. There's something about it, and it doesn't matter whether it's German or French or British. For me, it brings that inner peace to me, and I think that only comes from studying this subject and getting so immersed in it and engrossed in it. So I absolutely understand where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, and it's for me, you know, like Tynecop, for example, it always brings out emotions, you know, particularly in the summer. I mean, Tynecop, any time of the year, you know, if you go in when there's snow on the ground or whatever, but particularly in the summer when you walk in through the back entrance and you're confronted with that solid bank of red roses. And for us on the tours, that's the last stop of the tour, you know, and we've been through the trenches and we're told the stories and whatever. And quite often, you know, you get some big strapping guys walk into the back of Tynecop and just burst into tears, you know, when we see how beautiful, you know, that cemetery is. And I like to do that or that Tynecop quite close to Langemark so people can make the mental comparison, not only in terms of atmosphere and design, but scale as well. Because if you think, you know, Langemark's got, what, four times the amount of burials than Tynecop, probably about half the space. So there's a lot of, you know, contradictions, but, you know, things you can look at between the two cemeteries, you know, if you go close enough.
One of the things that I've seen when I've sort of looked in newspapers and obviously now with the advent of social media, it opens up the sort of the whole world. But it obviously is the frequency with which human remains are discovered of soldiers when there's road building and engineering and building projects. What happens now to German remains that are found in this part of the battle? Where are they buried?
Well, at the moment, they're buried in Langemark. Okay. If you look at Langemark itself, there's no burials now in the main part of the cemetery, the original plot A, the Eichenhain, the Oak Grove. There's no burials in the Ehrenfeld, where the German bunkers are. That's, you know, there's no room there anymore. They don't rebury there. Or in the mass graves. The mass grave was completed in the 1950s, you know, and sealed. But at the same time, where the plaques now are, underneath there, they dug a crypt. Now, it's never open to the public. The entrance is hidden, and it's hidden beneath the concrete slab where the Flanders shield is. And they remove that slab when there's burials, and it reveals a manhole cover, basically. And all they do is they open the manhole cover up, put a ladder down, and the German soldiers are now buried in short coffins, okay? Because don't forget, it's skeletal remains, and the coffin only has to be as long as the longest bone in the body, really. And it's stacked up in there. Again, it's the same height as the mass grave, around about 1.7 metres. So it's stacked up there from top to bottom. But I have been told recently it's getting quite full now, so they're going to start looking at other methods or other places to bury. But as it stands at the minute, they're still using Langemark.
And I take it you haven't had the opportunity to see inside.
No, they'll never let anybody down there. The only thing I will say in terms of the German burials, time has moved on, you know, and rightly so. And when you have German burials today, you know, they're very well attended by the local people. The local mayor will come. You know, lots of tourists will go. They'll invite, of course, the German ambassador, the German army. So they're big, big events now. So time has moved on and time has been a great healer. But 1950s, you know, that was a different thing.
So the last sort of question I think I'd really like to ask you is, you mentioned but way back at the beginning when we were talking about sort of Hitler when he was in prison and was this idea of this, the myth of Langemark. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about the book that you'd written was that you dispelled some of the myths that there are about the cemetery. And obviously, we've mentioned it before, the most famous one is that soldiers are buried standing up, which obviously, as you said, I mean, just it's nonsense. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
As part of your research, what were some of the myths that were, what were sort of some of the common myths that you were able to dispel as part of your research?
Well, you know, I mentioned about the significance of the names, you know, in the room of honor, the list room. You know, a lot of people misconstrue that and they tend to think that these are the names of all students, which is not the case. The buried standing up one, of course, you know, it makes no sense as it whatsoever. But I think where that's come from is when you actually work it out, burials per square meter in the cemetery, it's 4 burials a square meter. But of course, what that doesn't take into account is the 25,000 buried in a mass grave, you know, the size of a tennis court. That kind of throws everything out of kilter. Now, when you look at the actual burial plan of the cemetery, which is in the book, it's a massive grid system, and they're buried up and down in rows, very tightly packed, shoulder to shoulder. And I've actually seen the burials because a few years ago there was some work done, and they let some of the guides in to see how, you know, how they were buried in cotton bags. The bags have all rotted away now in a lot of cases, and the remains are quite in bad condition because over the years, of course, the ground has become, you know, heavily compressed. So they're buried shoulder to shoulder. And each one of those stones in plot A, the Eichenhain, is in the middle of 8 burial plots. So there's normally 8 names on each stone. If there's 7, it just means there's meant to be an empty burial plot. Now, I say there's meant to be because don't forget, the crosses had been taken. And then for 20 years, you had no burial markers pretty much. So the German authorities are quite happy to admit this, but the names on the stones do not necessarily represent the bodies buried beneath them in that area, plot A. They won't be far away, don't get me wrong. They won't be opposite ends of a cemetery, but not exactly where, maybe where their names are. When you get to plot B, when they rebury 10,000 German soldiers there in the 50s, when you get to that area, you'll see the stones are bigger. The pillar stones are bigger. They've got 16 names on average on each one, but they're still only in the middle of 8 burial plots. So what the Germans did at that point was put 2 bodies in each grave. Okay, so the myth about them being buried standing up, no, we know that's not the case because the German War Grave Commission sent me the burial plans. So I can even pinpoint on those where German Jewish soldiers are. You know, fantastic information. The second myth, you know, we get a lot, which I mentioned earlier, is, you know, particularly from the locals, we wouldn't let the Germans have upright headstones, you know. Again, we've gone through that. You know, there's purely a practical reason why, you know, the stones lay flat on the floor. But my favourite, which is what I told the German War Grave Commission, and it's ludicrous. You kind of get some of the locals will say, yeah, well, up until World War II, the cemetery had 10,000 burials. Yes, correct. Okay. And they'll tell you they had wooden crosses. Yes, correct. That's true. Okay. And then they'll tell you the crosses are black. Again, correct. But we told the Germans they had to have black crosses because it's the colour of evil. Yeah. So I told the German War Grave Commission this, Peter, when I was talking to him about it, and they just laughed. And they just said, look, the only reason the crosses are black or were black was because of the wood preservative we used to paint them with. It turned the wood black, simple as that. But you guys know, you know, particularly, in today's world, if a myth is repeated often enough, you know, it starts to become pseudo fact. So that was the real danger for me with Langemark. You know, people were believing all of this stuff, which is some of it is ludicrous.
It's I mean, it's fascinating sort of hear you talk about this, and you know, I mean, I must certainly congratulate you, because I think your book is magnificent. It's a triumph of research and shows what you can achieve by putting your mind to it. And I would certainly urge anyone who's sort of had their interest piqued by listening to this to do get yourself a copy. I believe it's you can get it on Amazon, I presume. And
it's fairly widely available.
It is Studentenfriedhof to Soldatenfriedhof, the history of Langemark, German cemetery and self-guided tour. And I mean, all that's really left for me to do, Roger, is just say thank you very, very much indeed for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure and a fascinating subject. And your obvious passion for this German cemetery shines through. And just thank you very much indeed to say for coming and talking and sharing your passion for this subject with us.
My pleasure, Matt. And thank you very much for inviting me onto your podcast. I really enjoyed our chat. Thank you.
You've been listening to an episode of Footsteps of the Fallen, the Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer Matt Dixon. There are lots of ways to keep in touch with what we're up to. The first point of call is, of course, our website at footstepsofthefallen.com. You can find me on Twitter at footsteps_pod, or we're also on Instagram as footstepsblog. And if you are enjoying what you're listening to and would like to help support the podcast, there's a number of ways that you can do that. You can either support us via Patreon, where you can find us at Footsteps of the Fallen, or through Buy Me a Coffee, where you can find us as Footsteps Pod. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I will look forward to having your company in our next episode as we continue to walk through the footsteps of the fallen.